Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome cooking teacher Pascal Beal and chef Jeremy Tummel. In today's episode, we'll talk to Pascal and Jeremy about what makes Santa Barbara such a special food place, treasures from the Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and we'll get another double Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Today, we're celebrating a place Julia loved and called home, Santa Barbara, where the Foundation is headquartered. We're coming to you live from the Saturday morning Santa Barbara Farmers Market. It's one of the oldest running of the new era of California farmers markets and a place Julia often shopped. It's one of the many reasons Julia loved Santa Barbara. While Julia is often associated with Boston, she was a born and bred Californian, raised in Pasadena. Her family frequented the Santa Barbara coast for weekend and summer getaways. Santa Barbara's beauty is a product of its unique geography, much like the French Riviera, where verdant mountains drop quickly down to Emerald Sea. This provides Santa Barbara with a temperate, Mediterranean-like climate. Where else can you savor freshly caught sea urchin and locally grown strawberries with a glass of award-winning local wine? Julia's love for the area and her embrace of its culinary riches inspired the Foundation to work with the Santa Barbara Culinary Experience to present the 2022 Taste of Santa Barbara, a week-long celebration of its food, drink, and hospitality industries. The Saturday morning Santa Barbara Farmers Market showcases the region's produce and growers all in one spot. Two people who deeply understand all that Santa Barbara offers are cooking teacher Pascal Beal and chef Jeremy Tummel of La Paloma Cafe. Jeremy and Pascal joined us live at the Saturday Santa Barbara Farmers Market on May 21st during the Taste of Santa Barbara. On today's show, they share their appreciation for the market and all that Santa Barbara offers. First up is Pascal Beal. Taught to cook by her French mother and grandmother, Pascal opened her Santa Barbara cooking school, Pascal's Kitchen, more than 20 years ago. With a focus on Mediterranean-style cooking, Pascal teaches classes featuring menus inspired by the local and seasonal food of Santa Barbara. She recently teamed up with Sandra Aduzelli to form Two Baking Brits, which produces culinary events, food collaborations, and digital media. As a writer, Pascal is the author of 9 cookbooks, which showcase local and seasonal fruit and vegetable recipes. Her most recent cookbook, Salad 2, More Recipes from the Market Table, was published in 2020. She also writes for local newspapers and food magazines, including Edible Santa Barbara. So I would like to welcome Pascal Beal to join us.
Thank you.
I'm going to sit down now to have a proper conversation with Pascal.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, thank you for being here. So we wanted to find out more about particularly where we are now at the Santa Barbara's Farmers Market, because it was a place that was important to Julia and is important to Santa Barbara. And, you know, I like to say unique in all the world in terms of not for a farmer's market, but for how amazing the farmer's market is. But can we start with what brought you to Santa Barbara?
So I was originally based, I'm not from these shores. I'm half English and half French. And I came to work in America for 1 year and came to LA first. And then after 14 years in a completely different industry, I moved to Santa Barbara in 1997. And that's when I first came here and discovered the farmers market almost immediately. It is, as you said, a unique farmers market. There's chefs, people who come from around the world who are used to farmers markets in really big cities, and they come here and then they go, my God, this is incredible. How did this farmers market materialize? And the quality of the food here is extraordinary.
Well, and I'm pretty sure it has a significant history. It's a little bit tricky to say. It's not the oldest farmers market in the country, because the farmers market existed before the industrialization of food, but it is one of the older ones of the sort of the return to having farmers markets.
Yes, and the lovely thing, so there are Santa Barbara has 6 farmers markets during the week, so every day but Monday. 2 of them are in Santa Barbara proper, and the Saturday one, the one that we're sitting in right now, it's in a parking lot, but the great thing is that it's a giant square, basically. So it has a very European feel about it, and it's a tree-covered square. So you walk up and down the aisles, and it's fabulous. It feels very Provençal, very Mediterranean, and that is, I mean, we're in the American Riviera. So for me, I feel like I stepped from Provence to, you know, to being here in California, and it feels like home.
And since we're on radio, I'll set the stage for the audience can see and hear what it feels like, but blue sky, the sun is shining, there's a very gentle, cool ocean breeze just keeping us very comfortable,
yes. Right? It's fabulous. I mean, Santa Barbara is unique in that it's, you know, hemmed in by the mountains on one side and the ocean on the other, so it tends to be cool year-round. But the local surrounding communities is sort of this rich farmland, which they just produce this extraordinary food. And we have amazing farmers here.
Well, and that's a key thing we really wanted to showcase with the Taste of Santa Barbara, is there's a unique sort of riches of this region, which has a lot to do with the climate and the geography. And I know actually you do Mediterranean style food as what you often teach and particularly write about, but it's very connected to what's available here in Santa Barbara and at the farmers market. So could you started to talk about how chefs come and find the market to be really unique and special. Could you go into more detail about what those elements are?
So let me go back one step.
No,
so
by all means.
The basis of all the cooking that I do, and I think most chefs do, is I eat seasonally, and I really follow what is in season, because you're tasting the food that is at its optimum. So I think chefs draw from that, and you'll see any number of them here early in the morning going through the market, and they'll suddenly see something and think, oh, that's going to be today's special, because, you know, right now we have zucchini blossoms that have just come into, and say, oh my God, I can make stuffed zucchinis. And we've just started with all the stone fruit, and you know, your mind starts racing, at least mine does.
I saw cherries and was a bit, it seems early for cherries, or
this is about right for us.
For here?
Yes. So that's the other thing.
Because cherries are still one thing you cannot get everywhere year round. So if you didn't see the cherries,
Now is the time. The cherries are amazing, and we're just coming into the sort of the big first rush of stone fruit. And I saw apricots
today. What stone fruit is local here? All of them? Or
Yeah, they are grown north of here and in the Central Valley, where it's warmer. But what's amazing to me is that here we get apricots and cherries in May and June. So my grandmother, who I learned to cook with, who I think of as my French Julia, they were uncannily similar.
Okay. Was she 6'3"?
No. No, she wasn't 6'3".
But in spirit.
In spirit. And in their cooking, in the way they cooked. So when I read Mastering the Arts, it's as if I was in my grandmother's kitchen, because this is her food. So.
And what part of France is your grandmother from?
She was from Normandy. She was born in Lyon, but she grew up in Normandy, the dairy capital of France. Yeah.
Normandy is all about butter.
All about butter and cream and crème fraîche. So in that sense, they were kindred spirits. But she lived in Briançon in the French Alps, okay, which is where my mother was born. And there in her garden, she had cherry trees and plum trees and apricot trees and everything. But because it was at altitude, all of those fruit came in the late summer. I mean, in summer and late summer. So I've always associated those fruits with a sort of summer or late summer fruits. So when I first came to the market here and it's May and there are cherries and apricots, I'm thinking, what is going on? This is a complete turnaround.
Because I'm used to being in the southwest of France where the unbelievable peaches, but they ripen in a 3-week window.
Yes.
And then they give them away for nothing because if you buy them at Whole Foods, they're expensive and they're usually hard as a rock.
Yeah.
So when are they gone by June?
I mean, the cherries, there aren't that many cherries this year. So right now there's a big flush of cherries and they're beautiful. But my guess is that 3 weeks from now, there won't be any cherries. And apricots, there are some years where the apricot season has lasted 4 weeks. So really good apricots that are that beautiful perfume that you get in apricots. And I love to make apricot jam and apricot clafoutis and all these different things with apricots. And you have that tiny window.
No, I was thinking about that too, because when they're ripe, they're wonderful, but yes, all those fruits have such a short season.
Yes.
That's why jam's made from them, because you have this overabundance, you can't eat anymore, but how do you keep that flavor all year round?
Well,
you have to do something preserved.
You preserve them, and then you've captured the essence of that season, and hopefully you've made enough to carry you through the year. So when I was little, I learned to make apricot jam with my grandmother. And we would take, we lived in London, she lived in Briançon, so it's quite far. And in those days, it took a long time to get there. And we would hand carry back these jars of apricot jam that we had made. And we'd try and make them last as long as possible. And there was nothing worse than you get to the bottom of the jar and you'd sit there and think. Then we'd try and put a call, a long distance call, through the operator. To get to the, it took a long time.
Yeah, no, a big investment.
It
yes,
was a big investment.
Not done except in emergency.
I remember when I was.
But apricot jam running out.
Apricot, yes, that was an emergency. Absolutely, please send jam.
People who care about food.
It's essential stuff.
So, do you in Pascal's Kitchen? Do you do courses? Do you ever do classes on making jam or?
No, because the jam is a two or three. My jam is a 2 or 3 day process, so I don't. I teach the. Everything that I've done, so this is the 23rd year of teaching classes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And in that time frame, I have never repeated a class.
Wow.
So creating all those recipes over the years has fueled my cookbooks and all the articles and everything. It's a great challenge for me.
Yeah.
And it's been so inspirational. I mean, I walk through the aisles here and I just think, oh, wow, okay, there's one of those. Or I'll see two things next to each other. So we are in cherry season. And one year we had, there were cherries, and I found the first of the tiny little tomatoes, the little cherry tomatoes. And I bought some cherry tomatoes and I bought some cherries. And I got home and they were sitting on the counter next to each other. And they're the same shape and size, practically. And I'm looking at these two things going, this is very interesting. I wonder what they'd taste like together. So I took a cherry and I took a tomato and ate them together. And I thought, oh my God, this is... So I made a salad out of that, which ended up in one of my books.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because your book series is very inspired by the market, seasonal eating. It's sort of a combination of market, seasonal eating, and the Mediterranean style food
that your
family history shares and Santa Barbara resembles. So when you've gone around either today or this week lately, what dishes are sort of springing top of mind that people could put together from the market finds?
So, I mean, right now there are all these edible flowers. Ooh. So a lot of eating is, for me, it's visual. You know, you eat with your eyes first. It's a classic saying. And there are...
I also think, I'll just interrupt you there, that the amazing thing to me, particularly at a farmer's market, is shopping with your eyes. Because if it looks good... at a farmer's market.
Yes.
Very likely tastes great. And
absolutely.
Is a good way to... your eyes first at the market
Your eyes first and, you know, smelling things. I mean, right now we're not tasting things because we haven't quite got back to sampling.
We might be here.
We might be. Well, yes. Yes. But normally, I mean, particularly the stone fruit vendors and the farmers, they have... You can taste the peaches and taste, and then you've got that, you know, the dripping juice of the fabulous succulent peaches, and you're just, oh my God. So you're asking, so there are white peaches.
Yeah, have you spied things that you're like, I know I'm going to make that?
White peaches. And then at Ojai Microgreens here, they have some amaranth, with the color of which is this purple, and you have these amazing bursts of color and edible flowers.
Do you want to describe what amaranth is? Because that's a very special thing. Is that hard?
Yeah.
Because it's amaranth is a grain, actually.
It is a grain,
but it flowers.
But it flowers, so it has this purple...
It's an ancient grain. It used to be... Well, I think that Native Americans used amaranth.
Oh, it's very ancient. But it has this... So the stems are purple, and these purple flowers. And
sort of like lavender.
She's going to scream at me because I promised I wouldn't mention the amaranth because she doesn't have that much left. But
just go look at it.
Just go and look at it. No. Go and buy it. Anyway, it's spectacular. And it adds this incredible just pop of color and taste. And then at Drake Family Farms, they have goat cheese, which resembles very much goat cheese from Provence. And they have white peaches. So white peaches with goat cheese, and then her family, H-E-R, Family Farms, which is just over here, have an abundance of basil, as does BD, who has, oh my God, the Nirvana of farms. He has a farm called Earth Trine Farms up in Ojai.
Okay.
It is truly one of the most beautiful farms I've ever been on.
Because
as you walk through, he has fruit trees there, and as you walk through the farm under the fruit trees are carpets of herbs that are grown.
Which is very Provençal.
And it is, you walk through and you're just sort of inhaling all of these aromas, and it's, I just want to lie down in the herbs. I don't want to get stung by the bees, but anyway, he has amazing basil as well, so... Lemon basil, Thai basil.
So are you composing a salad for us while we're talking?
Yes, I am. I'm composing in my head.
It sounds delicious. Now, would you dress that at all?
I would.
What would you put on?
I'd put a sort of fruity olive oil with some lemon zest and some lemon juice. Just very simple. A lemon vinaigrette.
So nothing sweeter than... I was wondering if you drizzle honey. I'm like a big fan of the honey drizzled over like white peaches.
Yes.
With like a...
But the peaches, so I like that balance of salty sweet. So if you've got the creaminess of the goat cheese, so you've got some salt in there. And actually here, if you've never tried them, there are Fat Uncle Farms. Have you ever heard of their almonds?
No.
Oh my God. They have these blistered almonds that are just extraordinary.
Is a blistered almond a type of almond that grows, or they do something to it?
No, they do something to it. So it's soaked in water, and then when they roast them, I'm probably describing this incorrectly, but anyway, they are...
Probably no one out here knows how to blister almonds. So.
You can ask them, they'll explain it. Okay. So they will... the water adheres to the skin of the... They skin the almonds, and then when they put seasoning on it, it adheres to the seasoning, and it creates these little pockets on the outside of the almond, And when you bite them, it's an almond unlike any almond. So on that salad, peaches, okay, goat cheese, different basil.
So we have white peaches, yes, local goat cheese, local basil. Yes. Was the amaranth going on the salad?
Maybe little tufts on the side, just for color.
And blistered almonds.
Yes.
And then the dressing is
a lemon vinaigrette.
Yeah. And can you get local olive oil? What olive oil do you get?
You can get local olive oil. You can even buy olive oil at the farmer's market, which is one-stop shopping. You can get everything here. Sometimes I'll add a little bit of vinegar, just to up the acid.
What kind? White wine vinegar?
I have white wine vinegar. I have a pear champagne vinegar.
Do you have your own vinegar mother?
Yes. No, I used to. I had a vinegar mother which I nursed for ages, and then an overzealous friend cleaning the kitchen.
That is a common refrain. Do folks know what a vinegar mother is? Has anybody seen one? Can you describe?
If
you come across one, you might be frightened. They're they're like little creatures.
So if you've ever bought a vinegar and in the bottom looks like this gelatinous blob, and you think, oh my God, something's gone wrong. It's got something growing in it. Yes, it does. It has something growing in it. That is what's making your vinegar. And this friend of mine had bought back from France. I won't say how.
Yes, that's not legal. But I know someone else who did that too.
Anyway, he brought me some of his grandmother's mother.
Because they'll last almost forever.
Yes, almost forever. So this was an extremely precious commodity. So I had this, and I had it in a special jar, and it sat on the counter. And then a friend staying with us said, oh my God, there's something weird growing in that, and threw the whole lot away. I cried.
Yeah, that's a crying moment.
It was a crying moment. You know how you walk through something and you know where everything is?
Yeah.
And I walked past and I thought, something's off. What is it? And I'm scanning the kitchen and there is the jar gleaming clean and empty. And I was apoplexic.
I think good advice is never throw anything out in someone else's kitchen without asking.
I haven't restarted one since then. I was traumatized.
No, that happened. That happened in our family. We had a vinegar mother that had been surreptitiously brought from France. I don't know how old it was, and it was cleaned out of. And it was actually cleaned out of the. It sat in a sort of looked like a big honey pot or a big cookie jar, and then it has a little tap on the bottom.
Exactly. Yep.
But if you had vinegar that's made like that, it has a complexity and depth that you're not going to get in a store-bought vinegar. Or even some of the gourmet vinegars are still, they're made in a more commercial, large-scale way. But.
So don't freak out if you see some thing in the bottom of your vinegar. It's actually a great sign, and then you could take that and nurture it.
Yeah, it's a little harder.
Please look that up.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't just chuck wine in it and do it.
Rosie's for vinegar, empty bottle, probably not.
No, that's not going to work.
If you want to up your salad game,
yes,
buying really good vinegar,
yes,
which you don't need a lot of, it's
no, you just need a little. I mean, my ratio for vinaigrette is always 3-1. For every 3 teaspoons, tablespoons, or whatever of olive oil, I add 1 of the acid. If it's lemon juice or vinegar or whatever it is. But when you're making vinaigrettes, just be sure that the vinegar that you're using doesn't overpower the ingredients. So everyone went through that balsamic phase. And balsamic is really strong. And it will, if you have beautiful butter lettuce or very light, delicate greens, if you use a strong vinaigrette, it'll just wipe out the essence of your greens.
Well, let's talk about that. I think there's a pairing aspect,
yes,
just like we talk about wine pairings, of pairing vinegars greens. Like balsamic to me works really well in arugula because it has a really strong flavor and it balances it.
Dark leafy greens.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The ones that have a strong.
Yes.
But with delicate lettuces or microgreens, you want a light vinegar.
Super light. That's why lemon juice and olive oil is great. Or a white wine vinegar, something really, really delicate. I want to taste you've gone to all this trouble of finding all this fabulous food, and then you wipe it out with a vinaigrette that takes away all the flavor of everything that you've got on the plate. That's sort of counter Massachusetts.
So you were talking about, you have a sort of signature, you said, is it pear champagne vinaigrette?
Yes.
So what is in that? I mean, it's, I could guess from the name, but how do you put it together?
So I use a nut mustard. I have a...
I don't know, what is a nut mustard?
It's a mustard with nuts. It has walnuts in it.
Oh, okay. So,
so, but you can use a regular Dijon mustard. And so a little bit of Dijon mustard, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, and a tablespoon of pear champagne vinegar, and whisk it together with a pinch of salt and a little bit of pepper.
No, it's pear champagne. I've never seen that before. Is it something you make, or
it's
something,
something
you actually source?
It's something that I source.
From a secret supplier.
From a secret supplier. That you can find at Pascal's
Only
Kitchen.
Students of your classes get
no,
the
No,
answer.
I have an online... So I don't have a brick-and-mortar store. I have an online shop. That's Pascal's Kitchen. So I've been here in Santa Barbara now for whatever it is, 25...
Wait, you're... Pascal's Kitchen is 23 years.
Pascal's Kitchen is 23 years. I've been here for 25. So that has, I've decided not to open a physical shop. So I'm in cyberspace. You can find me there.
You can say the website. What's the website?
Okay, pascalskitchen.com. I didn't know if I could say that.
You
so.
Absolutely can.
Okay.
After the break, we'll talk to Chef Jeremy Tummel from Santa Barbara's La Paloma Cafe. And stay tuned for another double Julia moment later in the show.
In the heart of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Lilia combines wood-fired seafood, handcrafted pasta, classic Italian cocktails, and warm hospitality. Since 2016, it's been celebrated as a neighborhood gathering place, bringing the best of Italy to New York City. Lilia is one of over 8,000 restaurants that leverage Bento Box to power their digital front door, including their website, gift cards, event management, and more. Bento Box is a marketing and commerce platform built specifically for the hospitality industry. With Bento Box, get discovered, make more money, and engage your diners so you can deliver great hospitality both in person and online. Visit getbento.com/chef today to learn more and get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Welcome back. We're talking to Chef Jeremy Tummel. A well-known Central Coast chef, Jeremy leads the culinary team at Santa Barbara's historic La Paloma Cafe, part of the Acme Hospitality Group. La Paloma Cafe serves ranchero-style food, mixing local seasonal fare with traditional Mexican and Spanish dishes, much like those eaten in California's earliest days. Its history as a fixture in Santa Barbara stretches back to 1938, when it opened as a Mexican restaurant. A third-generation Santa Barbaran, who is part Chumash, an indigenous band of Southern California Native Americans, Jeremy has worked at many acclaimed California dining venues, including the Wine Cask, Bacar Resort and Spa, for the Pebble Beach Company, the Rosewood Miramar Beach, and the Baron Star in Los Olivos. He's a graduate of Santa Barbara City College's Culinary Academy, where he's also taught.
Welcome to the podcast, Jeremy.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things I like about your background is you're really from Santa Barbara.
Yes, we are lucky to be third generation Santa Barbara. So been plugging away here for quite some time. It's a special place.
And so I wanted to ask you, before we talk about the market where we are now, as someone who grew up here, what to you is the embodiment? I think Santa Barbara is a really special place. That's certainly what we believe at the foundation. And a lot of it comes from the bounty of the food and agriculture and the sea and the geography and the climate. So what to you makes Santa Barbara so special?
Well, the people, of course. I mean, everybody here in Santa Barbara has a like-mind approach to living here and the kind of casual lifestyle and taking advantage of farmers markets and fishermen's markets and really enjoying the views and the beaches and the trails and the hikes and everything that this town has to offer. And I think 90% of people walk around in flip-flops and just enjoy their lifestyle, and I know I do. And
someone asked me what the dress code for the weekend was, and I said it's California. It's whatever you want to wear.
Yeah.
And growing up, were you as aware about the special nature of the food and what was grown here, or was it more about the climate? Like, when did you kind of turn on to that it was a special food scene?
Well, that's interesting enough how that ties into Julia Childs. I was very inspired by watching Julia Childs at a very young age. I think I was 4 or 5 when Mom would start letting me watch TV, and that was one of the only programs I could watch. So that kind of opened my eyes to what was happening. And then, believe it or not, my mom and I would come down to the farmers markets and fishermen's markets, and we would see Julia from time to time. And apparently I would ask my mom if we could follow her, you know, lightweight kind of stalker. I don't remember that, but my mom swears by it. So at that point, I really started getting interested in buying a couple pounds of shrimp at the market, taking it home. My mom would let me cook as long as I cleaned up. But she really let me kind of explore at a young age what we had to work with here in the kitchen.
How old did you start doing that?
I probably started cooking. Well, I always watched her and helped her in the kitchen. I started cooking independently probably when I was 8, maybe 8 or 9.
So it sounds like it was just something you had to do that you were just drawn towards.
Yes, I think it's motivated by a love of food. And the more you dive into it, the more you get to eat. And the more curious you are, the more you get to try. The more failures you have makes your successes that much sweeter, too. So I've definitely burned a couple shrimp in my days. But, you know, you learn the hard way, and then you learn the rewards that, okay, you help mom, you get to lick the batter, and you get to lick the bowl, and you get to be the first one to take a bite at something, or, you know, you get to kind of create and see that process.
I think that's such a great comment that Julia was really into, is failure is part of learning to cook.
Sure.
And we got to a place where everything was about perfection, and that I always think that the secret to anyone who's a great cook or chef is that they know how to fix problems. It's not that they never make mistakes.
Right.
It's that you know how to bail yourself out or turn a dish into something else.
You can adapt and adjust, yeah. A famous chef once says, you don't know good barbecue until you've had bad barbecue. So it's a lot to learn from that.
Yeah. Well, and that talented people who maybe even have a national profile or a restaurant of their own, they still mess up. It's not like it's perfection all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, right. I always feel like on Top Chef, you're like, don't serve that. You don't have to say, and it's the best decisions, actually. Yeah. Jaini has a famous moment where she has to pivot on the dessert, but it's knowing when to do that.
Yeah. I always say we're never perfect, but we're always improving. And I think that's a good slogan for cooks in the kitchen. Don't accept that you're doing something perfectly, because then you won't keep improving. We can always find new ways to be efficient and smarter and cleaner and better. So that's our goal.
Never perfect. We're always improving.
Exactly.
Well, I think that fits very much with Julia's lifelong learning sort of philosophy. It was very...
I would agree,
to her nature. Absolutely. But do you think there's a common characteristic of chefs, is that they always are, or good chefs?
I think it should be, yeah.
Should be.
Yeah, don't ever think that you've hit the golden road and you're there, because you take your foot off the gas and you start going downhill.
Right. Well, and then there's always a new ingredient that comes
absolutely.
Up, right?
Or absolutely.
Someone, which is often about what the farmers decide to grow. That,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because someone was asking me, they saw mulberries there. And, yep. and my my assumption is that the reason mulberries are grown now has a lot to do with the different immigrant populations that moved to Southern California. But I don't know, are they native? I don't think so.
We used to have a mulberry tree, and my little girl. hi, pumpkin. Hi, sweet pea. we used to have a mulberry tree in the
Since
front
we're on
yard.
Radio, I'll just say you're waving at a baby who's arrived at the market.
Yeah, that's my little girl. Glad she's here to see me. Sorry, I got distracted.
We're talking about mulberries.
Mulberries, yeah. We had a tree, a huge tree, actually. It's a very large tree and very messy because when they drop everywhere. But I revisited that tree about a couple weeks ago, and they were there, sure enough. So
and
it's a good. I feel like it's a good local seasonal fruit.
Do you think it might be native?
Yes.
And do you use mulberries in any of the cooking at La Paloma?
We have them in our... We have a Santa Barbara Farmer's Market fruit plate for brunch, and it's 100% fruits that we gather from the market.
Wow, that's a fascinating connection. We were talking earlier in the show with Pascal Beal about this sort of Mediterranean-style food that she does, and one of the reasons she does it is her background being French, but then also because the climate here is and what's grown here is very similar.
Yeah. It's a great climate.
So you mentioned when you discovered the farmer's market as a little kid.
Yeah.
And so have you basically been shopping here your whole life?
On and off, absolutely. Yeah.
When you're in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, when I'm in Santa Barbara. I was gone for about 12 years, I believe. I remember doing a cooking demonstration right down in that corner. I think it was in 2001 when I was at the Bacara. It was on my birthday, and that was a lot of fun. But that was just to promote Santa Barbara Farmers Market. We're down here every Saturday religiously for La Paloma. And any operation that I've worked in and around, we've always supported Farmers Market.
So you source maybe not all, but some of the food for the restaurant from the market or from the vendors at the market?
Yes. Not 100%, but as much as we possibly can. Yeah.
And so I guess we're kind of at the cusp of the end of spring, start of summer. What would, can you call out any finds or things that are coming into season that you found at the market that you think are must-haves?
Well, today I found macadamia nuts, which is
I saw that
really
too. Is,
cool.
that, is that new?
Yeah, well, I remember seeing them as a kid, but I haven't seen them in a long, long time. So that was fun to find. I always enjoy all the flowers this time of year. The spring flowers.
Edible flowers?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
What do you do? You really don't cook them. You use them in salad.
Mostly garnish, yeah, and cocktails. But, you know, peas, asparagus, the artichokes are looking great. Those are all fun. I was excited about the macadamia nuts. That's just a new treasure, like you said.
Yeah, and do you think it's a grower who just started planting them, or what?
They're in Carpinteria, yeah. So I know they're very hard to crack. It's a hard nut to crack. That's why they're so expensive.
Ba-dum-bum. And then are you getting some inspiration? Do you think you'll do? Did you buy some? Or are you going to do something with them?
They're right here.
Oh, you've got. That's why you keep turning around. All right. So what do you? I mean, will you just add them to a salad? What do you think?
We
you'll do
actually
them?
Put those currently on our fruit plate for brunch.
Oh, so you already use them? You just are sourcing them somewhere else?
Exactly. Now we know we can get them here.
Wow,
it's awesome.
Yeah,
we already did our shopping for the market today, and all the guys took the food back up, and we'll be open for brunch.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so what's going to be on the menu?
Well, we have our market fruit plate. We're using a lot of Garden of Salanova mix that's featured on our restaurant week menu. So we have the La Paloma salad that changes seasonally. So we're featuring her lettuces and Birkdahl Farms stone fruits, early season stone fruits, which are also very exciting part of this season.
Yeah, we were talking with Pascal about that here with the climate, the stone fruits come in much, much earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And cherries. So they're part of your market salad? Or?
Yes.
Tell us what's in the market salad.
Well, it's we call it the La Paloma's house salad. It's a hibiscus vinaigrette, the best lettuce we can get our hands on, candy pepitas, and seasonal fruit, which right now is pluots, rainier, and Bing cherries.
Cherries.
So really bright, fresh, delicious salad.
Great. And are there any vendors or farmers that are here that you really want to call out or who you work with routinely?
Well, we use Garden of primarily. Norma at Ojai Valley Sprouts here. We're religiously with her. Birkdahl Farms, McGrath Farms, Beattie Farms, Tutti Frutti, We try to get as much out from everybody as that we can.
And for those vendors that you just mentioned, what's kind of unique or special about what they do?
I just feel like they do the best quality. Garden of's product is just hands down superior product. I mean, you taste one of their turnips compared to another turnip, and you can just taste the kind of terroir. You can taste the care, the love and experience behind that. Tutti Frutti grows great tomatoes and peppers. Birkdahl does amazing stone fruits. You know, there's no one farmer that does it all well, so they specialize in certain crops, and that's what we're looking for, is whatever that farmer is doing the best.
And do you think that's their approach to farming, or?
I would think so, yeah. I mean, you can't grow everything, but grow what you grow well and improve over it year after year. Yeah, I would think that's the right approach.
So you've worked all over California, kind of,
main California
regions. Do you think there's something that distinguishes, like what you were talking earlier, that the Santa Barbara, particularly the Saturday Farmers Market where we are now, has a reputation of being a really special place? Do you feel like here you can get things from the local farmers that are harder to find or not as good quality other places?
That's a good question. I mean, I see some of these farmers when we go to the LA market or Santa Monica market, which is kind of nice to see familiar faces down there. The Monterey Farmers Market was nowhere near as abundant and you know, beautiful as this farmers market is, but they did have a decent selection. But again, it's where you are, and that kind of bases your creations. It's you work with what you have, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's what makes Santa Barbara so special. And I think during the Taste of Santa Barbara, one of the things we really wanted to highlight, that it's kind of a gift, right? It's like you can do a lot of things really well, but some of it just comes down to terroir, right? That Santa Barbara is uniquely placed geographically to kind of deliver, if you will.
You have a beautiful crab fishery and a beautiful avocado production. So you put those things together and naturally they're going to go well together.
Does that mean you end up with a crab and avocado dish on your menu?
We have, yes. But crab and avocado salad is a perfect example of a Santa Barbara just iconic dish.
And how seasonal is that? Or can you actually get it pretty fresh a good part of the year?
The crabs, I think, are pretty much year-round. They have certain small closures, just like the spot prawns do. But that's one of the products that you can find almost year-round here, if it's not too windy, of course.
Crab and wind?
Well, if it's too windy, you won't see many crabs at the markets
because fishermen don't go out. Yeah. Okay. And what about the avocados? Can you get good avocados year-round, or
I think
a season?
I think they gap a little bit here and there, but I know they have some beautiful ones down here. Carpinteria Haas avocados, those are delicious. It's almost year-round. Yeah.
And anything else you're planning on the menu as the seasons change at La Paloma?
Well, we'll continue to just come down here and get inspiration.
So how often do you change the menu? Is it quite
the core menu is kind of designed to be there for the fan favorites and for people would hope to find at La Paloma, which is old California cuisine, or what we call ranchero cuisine. It's also a very kind of unique spin on hopefully flavors that are familiar to a lot of people growing up here. You know, pozole, maybe you don't know what it is, but it'll taste familiar when you eat it. Or a tamale, or, you know, all these things that I grew up eating, we want to kind of put out there in the best light possible, and then change them seasonally.
And so, let's talk about what that is, because to me, ranchero-style food, it kind of combines sort of native traditions with sort of much more historic European settler traditions.
Yeah.
Both Spanish and Mexican, and then what is native to the region. Is that how you define
that's
it as
a,
well?
That's a good way to look at it. And you know, I personally look at California as a whole. You know, what was going on in California 100 years ago? Well, you know, the gold rush was kind of a big part of our state. So believe it or not, I draw a little inspiration from those times. I'm part Chumash Indian, so I try to bring in as much like truly indigenous ingredients as I can source. And then, you look at what the rancheros could have been eating back over an open fire, or what, you know, the fishermen might have been eating on a boat, or the farmers, you know, were eating in the fields. And through those kind of trains of thought, when we come up with a dish that sticks and fits that concept, it's really exciting.
Yeah, so 100 years ago, you kind of didn't have much choice but to eat locally and seasonally,
that's
right?
That's very true, yeah.
Right?
That's a great point. That's a great point.
And where does pozole connect in? Because I think of it as a very Mexican dish.
It is very Mexican.
But is it... would people have been eating pozole in California 100 years ago?
I believe so, yeah. And this one is vegan. It's all vegetable-based. It's a pozole verde. So a little bit healthier spin on it. Pretty well-received. I just feel like it fits in the menu concept very well.
And so you're saying you have some Chumash heritage.
Yes.
But is pozole something that has much indigenous part or really comes from Spanish food?
Well, my family that still lives on the reservation enjoys pozole and menudo on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day. That's a big annual kind of tradition. So whether it's a Chumash-based dish, I know that my family has enjoyed it for many, many years.
It's hard to parse out, but it would be something that the Chumash would eat traditionally.
Possibly.
Whether it was original.
Whether it was their cuisine or not, yes.
And maybe possible. Just for people who haven't had a pozole or menudo, can you describe what it is?
It's a hominy-based soup, very rich in flavor, a lot of Mexican oregano, radish, onion, lime. So bright, rich, bold, satisfying, feel-good food.
So I think of it as having pork in it, or it cannot.
Your traditional pozole rojo would have pork.
Yeah, but ours like is a trotter, right, or something like that?
Yeah, it could be a
That's what I thought was traditional.
No, that's the good stuff. Yeah.
After the break, we'll get another double Julia moment. Did you join us at the Taste of Santa Barbara? Let us know what you thought about it or about today's show. Send us an email or voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @JuliaChildJCF. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career.
So, Pascal, it's your turn. What's your Julia Moment?
So, I know you asked me to think about this, and I have lots of Julia Moments, and I was trying to think of one.
Oh, people cheat all the time and give us more than one.
Okay. Totally. So, this involves a number of people in my family, and the story starts in England. So we used to live in London, and my mum used to cook these very elaborate meals. And we had an American friend who was a business partner of my father's, and his name was Jay. Unfortunately, Jay is no longer with us. But Jay was a tough businessman. You know, if you think of it as a sort of bulldog businessman, that was Jay. And he had this, I mean, he was, you didn't want to come up against Jay. Let me just put it that way. So, but he was he loved food and he loved cooking. So whenever he was in town, he and my mother would cook. And they had this, once they had this epic sort of 3-day monster meal preparation, cooking a canard à l'orange, duck with orange, which is a classic Julia.
If it's on the menu, have it.
Have it, yes.
Daniel Balud does it in New York at Danielle. Other people do.
It's one of those old-fashioned dishes, but it was, you know, canard à l'orange became a family, I mean, that became a favorite of ours because of that meal. So that sets the stage. Jay cooking. And then later, when I came to the States, I used to work in commercial real estate, completely different field. That was his field. And so we worked together. And I've seen Jay in negotiations. And remember what I said? He's this tough guy. So I got to know Julia the last 5 years of her life. And she and I met through a strange set of circumstances. I actually saw her being interviewed, and the person interviewing her, and she's been asked this question many times, but the person interviewing her said, to what do you owe your longevity? And without missing a beat, and I know she's been quoted for this, but without missing a beat, she said, red meat and gin. And I looked at her. Now, remember, in England, her show never aired in England. So I didn't have this...
You didn't have that whole background.
I didn't have the whole background of who she was. I mean, I knew her book, and I knew... But I didn't understand the sort of...
She was Julia.
Yeah, she was Julia, you know. I mean, all somebody had to say was Julia, and you would think instantly of her. So I had seen her, and then I read her book, and then as I'm reading her book, I'm thinking, oh, it sounds like my grandmother's talking to me. So I sent her... She lived down the road from me. So I sent her a note, and I had cured some olives, and I sent her a note with the olives because I knew that she had a house in the south of France, and I thought, well, this is very Provençal. And I sent her a note basically saying, thank you for being you. I, never in a million years did I expect a response. A month later, I get this hand, this typed card. She sent these little cards on typewriter. Dear Pascal, you know, thank you for the olives. I took them to a friend's for dinner. And I'm looking at this card. I'm absolutely stunned. I sent her a thank you for the thank you, which was a jar of apricot jam. A week later, I got another card typed, Dear Pascal, oh my God, the jam, thank you so much, literally. And we took it to breakfast, we demolished it in one go. And I thought, well, I can't send her a third thank you, that would be a bit too much. But by...
Although she loved to correspond.
Yeah, she did. I love those cards. I've tucked them into various books. So she... through another set of circumstances, I met her. And when I met her, you know, there were a lot of people then, and I introduced myself, and I said, I'm the one who sent you the olives and the jam. And she looked at me and she went, I'm going away. I'll be back in 6 weeks. Here's my phone number. Call me. Okay. I was a bit nervous about that.
Which would be new, Julia, already. Totally sincere.
Totally, yes.
She loved all people.
At the time, I thought, okay, I will. So I did. And that led to the last five years, of us having many meals together. And I would invite her for lunch and dinner many times. And I would test recipes on her. That's another story. So remember Jay, right? We're getting back to that. So one day... it was my mother's birthday. We decided to have a dinner party. And I called Julia up and I said, you know, it's my mum's birthday. Do you want to come? Yes, absolutely. You know, come and pick me up. Okay. And then we're getting close to the day. And Jay calls and goes, I'm in town. You know, can we have dinner? And I'm sitting there going, okay, yeah, it's, you know, it's my mother's birthday. Oh, and so
and
they
knew your mother.
And he knew my mum. They used to cook. And he said, what's for dinner? And I said, you'll see. So we go and pick Jay up, and on the way back, we said, oh, we have to pick a friend up. And he said, oh, who's coming? And Mom looks at my mother's French, and so she has this very strong French accent. She goes, oh, it's a friend of ours, Julia. And he goes, okay. And then we're getting closer to Julia's house, and he goes, do I know Julia? And he said, she looks at him, and she goes, no, I don't think so. And then we're just pulling up to outside where she lived. And he said, hang on a second. What Julia are you talking about? And she goes, oh, it's Julia Child. And you have never seen a reaction. Suddenly, this was a three-year-old boy jumping up and down. He was in his 70s at the time, I think. And... He was transformed. Never seen anything like this. He leapt out of the car and he goes, I'll open the door. I'll hold her hand. So he got to her, and when he met her, he was completely speechless. He did not know what to do, and he's holding her, taking her to the car, helped her in. And we all have dinner together. So I sat him, he was sitting between my mother and Julia at the time, and I have this photograph. He looks like the Cheshire Cat. And he's beaming. And it's at that moment that I understood the power, everything that is Julia. Because here's this man who could fell somebody with his just a word, who was reduced to melted butter in front of her, completely captivated by who she was. And he was, I realized the impact that she had had on his life. and on so many people's lives. And I'm so thrilled that I got to, you know, just be with her and cook with her and hear her stories and
We're thrilled to hear that story, because I think that really does sum up her influence and impact in a very personal way. So
yes.
Thank you for that, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. It was lovely to be here.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. So, Jeremy, we want to get a Julia moment from you.
Yeah.
What's yours?
Well, it's more of a...
It can be a story.
Yeah, it's more of a full circle story for me, because like I mentioned, I was obsessed with Julia from a very young age. And then when I was going to culinary school at Santa Barbara City College, she would come through from time to time, and we were able to cook for her. And that was very exciting. And then later on in life, when I was cooking at Epiphany, I was a chef at Epiphany, she would come in fairly regularly. So having her come to the restaurant I was at and being able to chat with her and cook for her, that was, for me, that was a full circle and really kind of completed my initial inspiration and probably a big part of why I'm a chef today, to having the satisfaction and the reward of being able to cook for Julia.
And she didn't recognize you as the child stalker from the market.
No, she didn't remember me from the stalking days.
Do you remember what you served her at Epiphany?
I remember her last dinner that I was able to cook for her was she had a salad, the house salad. We sent her a small salmon amuse-bouche, and then she ordered a ribeye and had a gin martini, I believe. And that was one of her favorite things, a nice big steak and a gin martini.
As she said, red meat and gin. She wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't just a line.
No. But she was a lovely
way of living.
Yeah, lovely, lovely lady.
I bet she ate every bite.
Yep.
Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us on
My
Inside
pleasure.
Joy's Kitchen.
No, it's great.
Great
My
to
pleasure.
Be here in Santa Barbara. Thank you all for listening. Please
thank
tune
you.
In again.
Come
thank
and
you.
See us at La Paloma.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed one of our first shows recorded live on location in Julia's beloved Santa Barbara, where the foundation is based. To stay up to date on future plans from the Santa Barbara Culinary Experience and next year's Taste of Santa Barbara, make sure to follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram. For more about cooking classes with Pascal Beal, she's at Pascal's Kitchen and at Two Baking Brits on Instagram. To keep up with Chef Jeremy Tummel, it's at Chef_Jeremy_Tummel. And to eat at La Paloma Cafe, it's at La Paloma SB on Instagram. And make sure you're following the foundation. It's at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. Please rate the show and leave us a review if you haven't already. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer at the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Veltorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.